Hello, welcome back to English History, Fact and Fiction, episode the 8th, The Great. Yeah, we're going to find out why Alfred is called The Great this week. My name's Sig Newman, let's get on with it. Left you on a dodgy note there, didn't I? Marvellous seeing him and brains with stuff like music, because music's basically patterns and maths. No need to have some magical sky creature to explain music. If you ever want to play blues or rock and roll, you'll soon get familiar with a thing called a 1-4-5 progression. Yeah, interesting music. A lot of it's a palindrome. You play it backwards as well as forwards. Might have a crack at one of those next week. We'll have a crack at the marvellous Rachmaninoff's variation on a theme by Paganini. I think it's variation 17, unless the senile dementia's kicked in. We'll find that out next week. But this week, the music was, that's the important thing, music was by Ted Grieg. I thought we'd been doing a lot about Danes and Norsemen, so we might as well have a Norse composer there. Ted Grieg, most famous probably for the Peer Gynt suite, but this was the Piano Concerto, second movement, Adagio. Adagio meaning, take your time. We'll chill, it's okay, when you're ready. We better have a quick recap of last week. So last week Alfred got himself out of that swamp, got the boys together, dusted up Guthrum, and then adopted him as his grandson, Athelstan, and started to get some sort of peace. Then he got into building stuff, fortifications, had a look at reorganising the army, invented the Royal Navy, became overlord of some southern Welsh kings, and doing pretty good. Then we got that King Arnulf in German, finally a descendant of Charlemagne who knew his business. Big mobs of Danes getting kicked out of Europe, and they came again, the Great Army and Hastings Army. And they'll get helped by the theoretically peaceable East Anglian and Northumbrian Danes. But Alfred's plans all go pretty darn well, and he wins out. That army gets disbanded. Asa's left us somewhere around there. Asa leaves us hanging about 891. He writes a bit more about what a great guy Alfred is and about his sickness, but no more histories. Even though Alfred lived another 9 years, and Asa another 19 years, Asa just thought, I'm finished that book now, I'm going to go and do something else. Didn't wrap it up for us. So we're back to ordinary history. We finished up around about 897, let's just check in. Aethelflaed, Alfred's oldest girl, she's now 27, Lady of Mercia. And his eldest boy, Ted, is 23, known as Edward the Aetheling. Now, we translate Aetheling to be like prince, but it's not quite. You don't necessarily have to be the son of a king to be an Aetheling. Aetheling is more of a signifier that somebody thinks that when there's a job vacancy, wanted ad, wanted king, that Aetheling puts you right in the frame. Doesn't mean to say you're going to become the king, but you are a serious contender. And don't forget, he's got two cousins there, Aethelhelm and Aethelwold. These are Ethelred's boys. Now, some people thought that Alfred was kind of stacking the deck in favour of Edward by putting in guys into the Witten who were pro-Edward. He's also making sure Edward's got plenty of sworn guys or housecarls. Edward's led troops. A lot of historians, they give a lot of credit to Edward and Aethelred, the Lord of Mercia, for that big victory over the Great Army and Hastings Army. Aethelred probably gets a bit more of the credit, perhaps because Edward's having a bit of a stoush with his dad. We've got a bit of a romance story had happened. Feel like a bit of true romance, a little bit of Mills and Boone. We'll cover it a bit more when we get into Ted, but bottom line is he met some hot chick, and maybe married and maybe didn't, but he's got a boy by the name of Æthelstan. And I think the stoush is about Ted saying, oh, I love her, Daddy, I love her. And he's saying, no, fuck that. You've got to marry for power and glory. You don't marry just anybody, mate. You're going to be a king. 894, Guthred or Canute, whatever his name is, up in Northumbria there, the Danish king who we think was probably a Christian, appointed by St. Cuthbert. So fair chance he was a Christian. He's died, and we've been having this guy Sigfirth hanging around. He's going to make a bit of a hostile takeover. He's an old-school Viking. Now, we've got sort of old-school Viking back in Northumbria. Not good for us if we're English. This time, Alfred considers York to be hostile territory again and available for a takeover bid himself. But, you know, Alfred's getting a bit old for this stuff. We will find the Earl of Somerset moving around. He's gone quite a way. He'll be operating around Mercian territory, getting into little battles with Northumbrians. Then in 896, we have another naval battle down in Dorset this time. Brave Royal Navy comes across six Viking ships. Three are beached and three are on the water. So the ones on the beach, the guys are inland, and you've got three on the water. The Navy will take two of those three in the water, kill everybody, kill a lot of them, while the third escapes with apparently only five survivors. Alfred's Royal Navy, he's got those bigger, better ships, no good in an estuary when the tide's out, so they get stuck. And the Danes who were wandering around, they come back and wander over to the Saxon ships, and the records suggest 120 Danes died against 62 of our brave sailors. There was 120 Danes on three ships, 3 fours of 12 foot. Yeah, that's probably fair enough. 30 guys at the oars and 10 guys sitting on the bonnet. There were some other naval battles, and the history records that in this year, 20 ships and crews were lost. Unfortunately, it doesn't tell us whether it was Danes or Saxons or some of each. We don't know. But 20 ships are gone. Alfred will be leaving us soon. I'll just mention that to you in case you want to get the tissues out. There are some writings on his last few years. It's considered to be a golden age of peace. Of course, it's going to be brief. It indicates that he's quite a stern victor in regards to prisoners of war. No Geneva Convention going on, so hang the lot of them. And he seems to have been a bit of a happy granddad, even though there's something going on there with Ted and his girlfriend. He's pretty happy granddad to his grandson, Æthelstan. He gives his grandson some gifts, and these are going to become important. He'll give him a cloak, a jeweled belt, and a sword with a gold hilt. Pretty decent presents to his grandson. He'll also call Æthelstan Ætheling. There you go, happy times. Might be having a bit of a concern with one of his nephews, who might be chatting with Danes here and there. But he's still working. He's issuing charters for land grants and, of course, writing. He's very big into writing. 899, 900, or 901, take your pick, he will depart his mortal coil, or as Asa would say, he will go the way of all flesh. There you go. It just records, here departed Alfred, son of Æthelwulf, 6 nights before All Hallows Mass. So Alfred's dead, he's our first king, and we've got him all the way through his life to his death. We're going to have a bit of a look at his legacy. Got a bit of something in there. You can't just go from Alfred's dead to dissecting his corpse without something, can you? So that was a bit of the old Psalm 53. I thought that would be suitable for this podcast. It's about people like me. You know, roughly says that if you're an atheist, you're incapable of doing any good. I'd say that's fair enough. I'm pretty much a mediocre sort of guy myself. I did put it on in Aramaic. It was probably a bit stupid. I should have put it on in Latin for Alfred, but anyway. We've had our ceremony. immediate legacy we're going to. Well, just before I do the immediate legacy, I do want to say I have this thought rattling around in my head, so I might as well get it out there. There was that deal with the will of Aethel Wolf and Aethel Red when Alfred came in, and we're pretty sure the result of that was Alfred got everything. And there was a stuff about how he was talking to the Witten, saying, look, it's not about me, it's about justice. And probably because I was watching that a little YouTube clip of Trump with his bipartisan thing with the aptly named Dreamers, the children came to the USA, very small children without any citizenship, and Obama called them Dreamers and said he was going to do something about it. Unfortunately, Obama's legacy is, you know, he was a dreamer. He didn't seem to get that much done. Trump was saying, look, it's not about me. It's about what these people decide. What they decide, I'm going to go with that. And then, of course, now he's just getting his own way. And there's other things about when he was young, he was charming. You know, as soon as you hear about somebody being charming, to me, a little bell goes off and says, is this guy a psychopath? Yeah, I'm not saying that in a derogatory term. I'm not saying he's Hannibal Lecter or anything, but psychopaths are highly successful people. Let's get on with what we really know, not what I'm thinking about. Immediate legacy, we can look at his will. Only two Anglo-Saxon kings' wills survive. Alfred is one of those. Now, it's not the original. It is a copy. But even in the will, and his will, of course, is going to be different to my will. For a start, it's medieval. Secondly, he's a king. And so it's a big elaborate document. It's more than just who gets what. Even his will, he is looking at legislation. The land system under the Saxons traditionally was, the land was called folkland. And obviously nothing written down. We describe the borders by this river there and that forest there and whatever. Folkland was handed out by the Witten. Folkland is non-transferable to anybody else. Technically, it probably is, but it's not like real estate. It's not like I can sell my house to whoever I like, that type of thing. So non-transferable, but it is inherited by the family. It's for the family. When St. Augustine brought the light of Christianity and that book learning stuff, he also bought some laws. Folkland's no good to the church because there's no system of inheritance through family with the church. What Augustine wanted was a better tenure. They came up with bookland. All the land is now folkland, and some of the land is going to turn into bookland. And this is basically for the church. I really want you to forget about the front of house church. This podcast has nothing to do with the front of house. If you go into a Catholic service, well, it's a standard service, a bit of entertainment there. You do the ceremonies, you get your slug of cheap house red and whatever, burn some incense. If you go to the evangelicals, you might get a rock band and you get the pastor out and he gets into his, you know, rhythm pattern, rhythm pattern, rhythm pattern, rhythm pattern, praise Jesus, that type of stuff. It's all just showbiz, that stuff, front of house. We're really talking about the back of house, the big organization, and any religion has got an organization behind it, and the organization is no different to a business. You want land, you want money, you want power. That's what you want. Under the church's influence, they brought in bookland. This will describe certain parcels of land. It will become bookland. That's bookland because it'll be written down. The way you get a bit of bookland, it's granted by a charter. The king can write a charter. Other people can write charters. Aethelred is Lord of Mercia, but he can grant charters. The royal family can grant charters. They introduced this bookland for the church, and part of the deal was, it's the church, so no taxes. You don't have to be involved in the feud-type idea, so your labourers don't have to build fortifications or anything, and they don't have to turn up for a fight. If you're an earl, say, or a thane, you're going to be saying, this bookland sounds all right. Other people started to want it, of course, so that's what they did. They started turning things into bookland. The no taxation and no feud didn't apply to earls and thanes. Suddenly now land can be transferred and there's a written record. Getting back to Alfred and his will, even in his will, he's saying that folkland should now be able to be bequeathed. You might be able to cut off a bit for your favourite nephew or something like that. He was a guy that was influenced by the early contemporary Christian philosophers who stressed justice, equality, and piety, looking after the poor, and of course being stern when faced with invaders or any bad people. We do have to revisit the story of the cakes, because that's the one that goes all through time, from the time Alfred's dead all the way through to, well, certainly the early 20th century when I was a schoolboy, because that's the history they gave me at school. I think that one I gave you, which was that one? It's the one where her husband's off fishing. I think that's the one that was doing the rounds in the middle 20th century when I was a schoolboy. The story has changed and evolved. You might say, why do we care about it? The reason we care about it is because that is the history for a long time of King Alfred. It's all tied up with the burning of the cakes. Burning the cakes is not just that particular incident, it's about being in the swamp. If we try and find the original, bit difficult, let's tell it this way. Alfred, as a young guy, goes to Njot. Aethelwulf did get to bang Judith and have another baby or two, and one of them was Njot. It's just a fairy tale, don't worry about it. He's not Saint Njot yet, he's just Njot. And Njot tells Alfred, you've got to stop being a bloody, stupid, evil little princeling and start being more of a royal sort of guy. Then the action then skips to Alfred being surrounded by Guthrum's forces and he gets away. I think in the original story, it's just Alfred. It's got nobody. He's on his own and he gets away to the island where he's going to be there for 3 years instead of 10 weeks. And then originally it's a pig herder, I think, with an evil wife. Njot turns up. He's Saint Njot by now. He turns up in a physical form initially, disguised as a wandering beggar. Alfred's sitting there eating cake or bread and drinking wine and gives half of his to this strange beggar to show that he's a nice guy. So then Njot comes back as a vision and says to him, you know, you're going to be great. Everything's going to... dear me. Guthrum becomes Goliath and then he turns into Athelstan, which is like the old Saul of Damascus being St. Paul. I guess the point is it changes and evolves to suit the times. It changes constantly through medieval and the Renaissance times, right through to the 20th century. Alfred is the big name for not only Saxon kings, but also when the Normans come along and they're looking at history. He's the big guy for quite a while. His reputation will take a bit of a hit under Hank VII, Henry Tudor, and that's because of that bloody dickhead Geoffrey of Monmouth coming up with his Arthur. So Arthur becomes the big warrior king. But Alfred doesn't disappear. He becomes the morality tale. If you want your fun story, you go to Arthur. And if you want a story about how you should be a good king, you still go to Alfred. Now, his legislative works should be stressed. He did really good with this stuff. First guy in Anglo-Saxon times to write laws was Aethelbert of Kent. These come from the guys with St. Augustine to help him write stuff. By the time we get to Alfred, what we're looking at is a mix of the old Roman laws brought by the Christians, which is basically the emperor rules, that's it, plus you've got your old Hebrew laws and Christian stuff. And on top of that, you've got the Anglo-Saxon traditional unwritten laws, which we tend to call common law. Alfred's got to juggle these three concepts together to get a law basis for England. Saying England now because that's probably what it's going to be. He's got to take, apart from all those, he's got to consider the laws of Wessex, Mercia and Kent. Probably doesn't have to worry about Kent so much because it's pretty much absorbed, but he's got to think about what are the laws in Mercia compared to the laws in Wessex because he wants a law for England. So he'll gather all sorts of information, he'll toss some out, and then he'll start writing his laws. Start with the Ten Commandments, that's what you've got to do. He'll add some of the stuff from the Hebrew Bible, toss in a bit of Jesus, who came not to change the law but to fulfill it, as we remember, and finish that part with the Golden Rule, which is do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. Then he's got to get his Saxon laws into it. So part two of the laws is an introduction by Alfred saying what it's all about. And then part three, he gets into the Saxon laws, which is basically the Wergild, so the tradition of fines, rather than the Hebrew death penalty. Still going to have a death penalty in there, fighting in the King's Hall, can't do that. The biggest crime of all is known as the Judas crime, which is treachery or treason. That's absolute death for that. Part of the deal here with the Word Guild is also you're trying to get away from feuds. You don't want people feuding, your guys feuding. They can feud with people from other places, but not internal feuds. And that's why we have the Word Guild. And then part four are the dooms of Inni, the first Christian king of Wessex. We're not terribly sure if he went back to the first Christian king of Kent, Aethelbert, or Offa of Mercia, and included those, but they're just Word Guilds anyway. It seems, at the end of the day, that these are really Alfred's laws rather than the Witten's laws. Now, traditionally, all laws were done by the Witten. He didn't totally keep the Witten out. He used them to help him exclude laws rather than include. The other thing is the laws are written in English, and we're going to have English laws now for maybe 160 years, and then everything's going to change. But it's important to have the laws in the language of your people. Think of yourself wherever you are. If all our laws were written in Latin and you can't read Latin, you haven't got much of a hope, have you? It's also some trial by peers. It's not all just the king's justice or king's justice as dispensed by his nobles. You can have a trial by peers. The concept of thanes changed under Alfred. He expanded them. So traditionally, the thanes was a hard warrior guy who you thought was pretty good and who could attract some other warriors to himself. You might make him a thane, you give him a bit of land, and so he can make some money and live. Now, minor landholders who may not be warrior types, they become thanes. High-ranking servants became thanes, so you like thane of the horse and so on. And these guys become like an early jury. Depending on your crime, let's say you're up for murder. Murder would require 12 thanes. Think of them as a jury. If they decide you're innocent, well, you're innocent. The important thing of getting your laws written down then is that if you've got earls or thanes or reeves dispensing your laws, they can't make shit up. They can't just say, oh, no, the law's this because it's written down. Alfred will also continue into literature and education. He's very keen on translating Latin works into Old English to make them accessible, and he gathers lots of learned men to his court. He even expands education to promising poor kiddies. This is the time then when we actually see Alfred starting to insist that his nobles are literate. Medieval guys put that in earlier, but it's around about this time. Alfred requires them all to be literate. There's some other made-up stories here about the founding of Oxford, Oxford being the famous university, and Oxford's big competition is Cambridge University up the road there. Both of those during medieval times and Renaissance times and beyond show us that just because you're an academic, a professor, head of one of the world's leading universities, doesn't mean to say you're not a stupid idiot, because they're in competition, Cambridge and Oxford, to say which one was founded first. Oxford at one stage has Alfred as founding it. Very, very bloody unlikely. And later on, when Cambridge comes up with something even earlier than that, then I think Oxford says, oh, yeah, it was founded earlier. It was we said Alfred because he's the guy that made it really good. All that, I think, is just fabricated bullshit by idiots. When we look at the writings about Alfred, there's lots of references describing him as steering the ship of state, that type of thing. He's steering the ship of state. He's not any sort of hard despot. He'll look at philosophy for how he should be king. He describes kingship as the art of arts and the craft of crafts. He sees his three tools of kingship as clergy, warriors, and workers, and all his tools need to be kept in good condition, fed, housed, equipped, etc. We do have some stories about international relationships. There's one about mission to India or Hindustan. Might be that. It's known as the end of the earth. So the end of the earth, we think, is probably India. Letters from the Patriarch of Jerusalem, which is now Muslim territory. We've got pilgrims going there. Of course, he's considered to be religious. He's dead. Nobody really knows where you can find him. He gets the name The Great. Hashtag the Great, that's what we should call him. Alfred hashtag the Great. That'll happen sometime in the 16th century. It's one of those things that just sort of happened by itself. People started talking about Alfred the Great. It caught on. In regards to the pious stuff, well, he did give a lot of work to clerical scholars from Mercia, Wales and overseas. He was looking to bring the best scholars to the court, and they happened to be religious guys. Asser has him spending half his day in prayer or reading holy works. On the flip side, he was, towards the end there, he was taking some strategically sited church lands back from the church, especially along the border with the Danelaw or York, transferring those properties to royal thanes, which you'd say, well, that seemed pretty bloody reasonable. Just as long as you give the church some other block of land, they should keep their gobs shut and be happy. But, you know, we're not church people. Well, I'm not a church person, so they're going to be pissed off by that, even though it's a bloody good idea. We did have that Judas accusation, if you recall, when he took either an entire monastery or baby Jesus' precious toys to give to the Danes. While he did re-establish relationships with the Pope, he's going to have a bit of a dust-up with the Pope. Now, back in the day, state and church, they're different but kind of the same. Think of the Pope as the chairman of the board and the king as the CEO. So the CEO's there, the king, he gets to make the appointments. You'll be an abbot, you'll be a bishop, whatever. And he gets complaints from the Pope about English churchmen. They're not wearing the right clothes, not wearing baby Jesus's clothes. And oh, horror of horrors, they're hanging around with women. Now, this is total bullshit, this hanging around with women. Catholic Church, they go, sometimes it's okay to marry, sometimes it isn't, depending on who's the Pope. You get one of those Stoic Popes, you've got to be totally celibate. That's Stoic bloody philosophy, that's total crap. Here it is in a nutshell. Other people can make you miserable, that's a bad thing. Therefore, you should make yourself miserable all the time, because if you're already miserable, nobody can make you miserable. What a crock of fucking shit. And that's what the Catholic Church, I reckon, took on from those Roman Stoics. Complaints about hanging around with women, living as laymen. You've got to figure back in this time in Wessex, it's not that easy to get new recruits because a monk's head is the Danes' favourite spot to lodge an axe. Good help, hard to find. Alfred is not a saint, otherwise I'd have been calling him Saint Alfred plenty of times. Henry the Sixth, Hank Sixth of England in 1441 had a crack at getting him canonised by the Pope, but he failed. If Alfred wanted to be a saint, he should have just gone and got himself killed by Danes. Would have been easy. And for a while, like immediately after his death, he did have competition from that idiot St. Edmund of East Anglia, who told the Danes that story about how you can get arrows stuck in you and live. Huh. Didn't help Edmund. So the literature, yeah, translations into English, sometimes by Alfred himself. He did a bit of translating, both literal and meaning type translations. And the works he produced in English range from The Consolation of Philosophy by Boethius. I think we spoke about that previously. Not going to go over it again. Boethius talking to imaginary women named Philosophy. And military works. When we look at some of these translations in modern days, we see that these guys really didn't quite get the idea of the might of something like the Roman Empire. They didn't quite understand it. Got the Welsh on side, reformed the army, built the navy, invented that new style of ship. Either invented himself or, you know, I don't think he probably did, but got the best brains around and said, come on, we've got to come up with a bigger, better ship. Constructed those bridges, reinforced defences, introduced the Burrs, secured the defence of the realm, put England in a position to play offence rather than defence. Said to be a bit of a polymath with wide interests. Apparently a very good craftsman and would instruct goldsmiths, show them how he wanted things done. We get this picture of a guy who's very practical rather than creative. The big one for me, I think, is coming back to justice. So he's written the laws, now it's about dispensing the laws. Alfred certainly sent out the message saying, look, if you think your reeve's not giving you justice, go to your thane. If you think he's still not giving you justice, go to your earl. If you think he's still not giving you justice, come to me. Come to me, I'll hear your case. It wasn't just bullshit. He genuinely took on all sorts of cases that were in dispute, and he is considered to be an extremely just judge. He would chastise members of the Witan if he thought they were making bad decisions, and he'd say things like, you're a wise man, but perhaps you shouldn't be here until you actually learn to be wise. Then he'd give him some tips, and this tip, it's a terrific tip. So you're having problems with your judgment. It's one of four things, either love, fear, hate, or greed. If you think about that, that's it, in a nutshell. One of those four things is causing you to make a decision that is not just. So he was happy to fine bad judges if they made a bad decision as well, and even sack them. Even sack them. No problem for Alfred. Now, there's no hierarchy in the law. I'm talking about that system. If you think your reeve is and then go to the next guy, it's basically just getting another opinion. It's not that you're going to a higher court. Alfred's court is the same as the 100 reeve court. So no hierarchy of laws. Everybody gets the same laws, the same code, at the same level. Appeals that Alfred is famous for taking is basically because of his reputation as being just. Seems to have been a decent tax collector and pretty bloody good administrator. With the taxes, he had two funds, secular and ecclesiastical. The secular fund was for the maintenance of the warrior thanes and the artificers, these skilled people, maybe inventors, and people who came to his court. Then the ecclesiastical would fund new religious houses. Some would go to the poor, some would go to education, the school, and money to monasteries. These are monasteries in Wessex and Mercia, and they would give gifts to Cornwall, Wales, and Northumbria, and even Brittany across the seas for ecclesiastical works like monasteries and so on. Plus, he made other donations out of that fund. Apparently, he sent some money to the Patriarch of Jerusalem, and bear in mind, Patriarch of Jerusalem, he's a senior Christian guy sitting in a city that is under Muslim control, so he's probably not making much money there. Let's do a burial. He was originally buried in the Old Minster in Winchester, but 4 years after that, the monks dug him up, moved him to the New Minster. We'll get to Henry I. Henry I wanted to expand his palace at Winchester, because bear in mind at this stage, Winchester is the place. London's not the capital, Winchester is. So Henry I wanted to expand his palace. New Minster was demolished. The New Minster was rebuilt at Hyde's, so we think that Alfred went up there in 1110, and along with his wife's body, and I think it's Ted's body. We're going to have the Mad Welshman, Hank VIII. He's going to, not personally, not even Cromwell personally, but you know, in that sort of smash up the old religion and steal every bit of whatever we can get. The church that Alfred and his family were in seemed to have been demolished, but the graves were left intact. But nobody cared. Nobody gave a stuff. Now, they're talking about Alfred all through these years as, not calling him Alfred the Great yet, but what a guy type of thing. You think, after the Mad Welshman, you think somebody would do something about those graves, but I don't know. I think it's in about either the late 18th or early 19th century. Somebody decided this will be a good site to build a jail. So they sent the workmen out, and the workmen just smashed up those graves. We think that's what happened because some parts of the tombs were recovered, and it certainly indicates at least Alfred in there. And if it's Alfred and there's three, then we're pretty sure that would be Alfred, his missus, and dear little Ted. The bones just scattered. So there you go. You can be possibly the greatest king of England, and nobody gives a fuck about you after you're dead. Well, your physical bit. But that doesn't matter, because Alfred is living on in our memories. And I think we're going to draw a close on Alfred there. It's time to call the Witten to a Witten Magot. I've interrupted myself here because I've got this kind of defect. Well, probably got quite a few defects, but this defect I've got happens with certain words, and one of the words is Wittenagemot, which is actually Wittenagemot, not Wittenagemot, Wittenagemot. But I can only say Wittenagemot if I really stop to think about saying Wittenagemot. So, I don't know. I'll give it a go, but I'll probably say Wittenagemot. Why did I stop this? Let's get it started again. Hi, Sandy. Hi, Bobby. Where are you guys going?
We're going to the Whittemagot.
Can I come too?
No, Sandy.
Why not, Bobby?
Because you don't have a penis.
Nah, just kidding. If you're listening to this, you're a human female in the 21st century. You are most welcome to join us at the Whittemagot. Obviously, you can't have your say. Just thinking, yeah, maybe before we do the Whittemagot, maybe we'll introduce a new little segment, bullshit that humans come up with. Going back to our priests and our monks, having a good old time there in Alfred's time, banging the chicks. Of course, these days you can't. Priests must be celibate. Priests cannot marry. We've got that right. We all agree. Priests can't marry. But you can be a married priest. There you go. How does this bullshit work? It comes like this. In the USA, the good old USA, of course, we've got tons and tons of churches. And some of them go back. There's one that I want to talk about, the Episcopalian Church, founded by those early Puritans in Virginia. I'd say you might be thinking Virginia and Christian churches, you're saying you're going to come up with something weird here, Dick. Look, if you live in Virginia, you know, you might want to know that people from other parts of the world see you as potentially very strange. But I can assure the rest of the world, people in Virginia, they're the same as people everywhere in the world. There's tons of good ones, lovely people. And the odd weirdo. The Episcopalian Church, founded way back by the Puritans in Virginia. They're kind of like High Anglican, and High Anglican's kind of like Catholic, so it's all kind of like the same. But the Episcopalians, they're quite strange Christians. They live in the 21st century, these guys, and they've kind of kept pace with social reforms. Very strange for Christians. Black people are okay. You can have, females can be priests. I can't do all those. Lesbians and gays can get married. Stuff like that. That's not going to go down that well with your congregation in Virginia, USA. Of course, it's not going to go down that well with some of your front men, the salesmen, the guys putting on a show. So some of these guys, these Episcopalians, have said, well, what's the closest thing we reckon to our stuff? But where they still aren't going to have bullshit like gay people can get married, you know, we're not going to have that. They went to the Catholics. And, of course, the Catholics in the US, they're declining. They're finding it hard to get people in to do front of house. And personally, I'd never go into front of house for the bloody Catholics and tell me I can't bang chicks. No way. Banging chicks is great. So they've gone off to the Catholics and said, hey, you need priests. We need a religion that's a bit harsher than our own, so what about a deal? And off they go. Of course, they say the Catholics, by the way, I've got a wife. And the Catholics are saying, yeah, no, that's okay. That's good. That's good. You just have to do our brief online course of how to be a Catholic priest. Make sure you never get yeast into your bread before you give it to people, because baby Jesus would be cross. And we're all good. I'm not sure the numbers. There's somewhere between 40 and a couple of hundred married Catholic priests in the US of A. So there you go. That's bullshit people come up with for this week. We better get back to the Witten. They're standing around tapping their toes waiting for us. So we've got the Whittemagot. And I'm going to have a crack at Old English again. I haven't done that for a while. We're going to have a Whittemagot. Yeah. Don't think I'll win any prizes for that one. And we have got two contenders. Firstly, Edward, son of Alfred. And the other contender is his cousin, Æthelwold, son of Ethelred. We know that Edward is known as the Æthling, which means he is well and truly in the frame for this. Æthelwold, not known as Æthelling, but his name starts with Æthel, meaning noble, so therefore he's a contender. Æthelwold did have a brother, Æthelhelm. We're not even sure if he's still alive. He's named in Alfred's will, but that does not necessarily mean he's still alive. But one way or another, he's out of the story. So let's forget him. Let's forget him. Going to come back to that earlier problem with wills. There is a chance that those two boys, Æthelhelm and Æthelwold, may have missed out when Alfred took pretty much everything for himself. And of course, in his will, the lion's share is going to go to his children. Æthelhelm will be left 8 estates. That's not too bad. But Æthelwold, only 3. The more land you've got, the greater your chance of being king, the wealthier you'll be, the more guys you're going to have in your housecarls and so on. Æthelwold's not looking that good. Alfred had also stacked the decks, we think, by promoting men into the Witan who could be relied on to support both him and his son after him. And he gave Edward opportunities for commanding battle once he was old enough. He made sure Edward got plenty of sworn men or housecarls. And one of these housecarls was a guy called Osfirth. Now, he's that probable illegitimate son of Alfred, so making him kind of a half-brother to Edward. He also gets some land in the will, which kind of strengthens the thought that he is definitely Alfred's illegitimate son. Coming back from that sexy French maid who used to bend over to sweep out the ashes instead of crouching down modestly. And, of course, you can only look at those black stockings and suspenders with frilly white knickers so long before shit happens. There's also a thought that Edward may have already been a kind of under-king of Kent. Coming back to Æthelwold, not got much going for him. He was a son of King Æthelred, who apparently died from stress on the job. Not got much going for him there. On the other side of the coin, his mum might have actually been one of those queens that we don't have. And I did give that disclaimer right at the start, saying Saxons don't have queens, but we find, oddly enough, the odd queen. Let's look at our main challenger, Ted, born in 874, so he's 25 at the time. He's led troops successfully when he was 19, defeating the Danes at the Battle of Farnham, although that was the one where he couldn't follow up because time for the feud to have their 2 months off. Bloody feud, I'll be glad when we get past that filthy term. But the situation was saved by the arrival of troops from London and probably by Æthelred, or it could have been Alfred. Back to the Witan. Where's your money? Where's your money? It's on Edward, isn't it? Edward, and you've done well. Edward means protector of the wealth, and of course the wealth means the nation. And let's just remind ourselves that he's got an older sister, Æthelflæd, married to Earl of Mercia or Lord of Mercia, Æthelred. So quite powerful. Now, coming back to when he was 19, not only did he win a battle, but he found himself a hot chick as well. So he found some Sheila by the name of Ecgwin, who's noted as king's consort in some places. So it doesn't mean to say they weren't married, but if they were, then it's a marriage that's not going to get recognised because we don't want it. We don't know much about Ecgwin or what happened to her. Some propaganda says she's highborn, others say she is a shepherd's girl. Æthelstan, the boy, we might call him Æthelstan Snow.
Alfred will send Æthelstan off to live with Auntie Fled and Uncle Ted in Mercia.
Of course, he obviously liked Æthelstan because we mentioned that he gave him those gifts. Edward and Ecgwin may have had another daughter. If they did, she will marry Sitric, a Dane who's going to become King of York. But apart from that, Edward might have had 12 kiddies. So spouse number two, I'll call her spouse number two because we don't know if she's wife one or wife two, really. So spouse number two, a Sheila by the name of Æthelflæd, and they'll have 8 children. She's allegedly the daughter of Earl Æthelham of Wiltshire, so marrying to cement relationships with Wiltshire. So the kids, let's get through them nice and quick. Eldest will be Æthelflæd, and he'll be a king for about a month after Edward. And then Edwin, he will live a little bit longer, but he's going to have an unfortunate boating accident. And there's some thoughts that maybe Æthelstan might have been involved in that unfortunate accident, but we'll get to there. We're going to have some girls. Edgifu, she'll marry Charles III of West Francia, so that's like France type of area. Then Edhild will marry a Frankish Duke, Hugh the Great. Edgith will marry Otto, King of the East Franks, so that's around that Saxony area in Germany. And then there's 3 more girls. We don't know much about them. They may have gone off with Edgith to that kind of Saxony area. Then he'll have another wife or spouse. So wife 3 or wife 2, who knows. Edgifu, daughter of Sigahelm, the alderman of Kent or Earl of Kent. And they'll have a couple of boys, Edmund, who'll become king, and Edred, who'll become king. Plus they'll have 1 girl, Edbird, Saint Nun Edbird. And the legend says that when he had Edbird, she's obviously the youngest of the lot, when she's just a toddler, he placed 2 piles of objects in front of her, reflecting life choices. The worldly choice, jewels and stuff, royal type plates and whatever. On the other pile, like a communion plate, a chalice and a book, a gospel book. And Little Ebert at H3 showed no interest in the kingly type items and went straight to the religious objects. And that was that. She sealed her fate. She's off to the nunnery, that girl. And of course, she'll perform post-mortem miracles, as you do. And that's about where we're going to leave it for today. I'm sorry to tell you, Edward's going to get straight into some unhappy times, but that's for next week. Now, I haven't spoken about historical fiction for a while because really we've been doing the Viking show and Bernard Cornwell series. Didn't speak much about Bernard Cornwell series because it's the warrior type novel, so Uhtred is the main character. The history goes on in the background and it's pretty accurate. I haven't been reading a lot of historical fiction because I've been reading history for this. But I thought I might have a little break from it, and I went back to Bernard Cornwell because I just felt like something light. Now, I'm not being derogatory here, but Bernard Cornwell writes ripping yarns. He's not going to make the plot too complex for you, and like his narrator, Uhtred, he'll remind you from time to time. If a character comes back, Uhtred thinks, well, you might have forgotten who this guy is. He'll give you a quick reminder so you can keep along with the story. It's light, it's fast, it's easy to read, and nice for the beach. I turn back to old Bernard because there's one of his I've been meaning to read called Stonehenge. You know, I'm glad I did. I thought it was pretty terrific. About the building of Stonehenge, he does it quicker than I thought I would do it in my own mind. And there's a lot about primitive religion in there, because all religions pretty much start the same. You know, you're going to have one great creator, and we're going to start worshipping the sun, and then we notice there's an other round thing called the moon, so we're going to have, you know, stuff about that. But it's just a matter of what we're going to go out with, and this week I've been listening to a bit of Briggs, so I thought we'll go out with Briggs and Bad Apples. Now, at this stage, I'd like to introduce you to my brand new sign-off. You're going to think it's great. You're going to say, how did he come up with this? That's what I'd like to do, but I can't because I haven't thought of one. Hope to see you next week.
They've gone from stealing bikes to stealing lives. So many young hands grip a stainless steel knife. See a kid they don't like, they're messing him up. What's wrong or what's right is given less of a fuck. Sticking them up, left, right, stitching them up. Everything revolves around getting the cut. Middle fingers up, fist of cuffs, pissing it up. Before the pen license, fisting the cuffs. They don't use them to pack shells, they use them to pack cells. Up in the system before they even crack 12. You can paint a pretty picture using northern pastels, but it's black and white and the ladder still sells. What kind of life is that? They're getting born intact. Teacher can't reach them, I'm getting fucking bored of that. They couldn't spell the name off the bat. I bet you they can tell you where to score a quarter at.